Hi, my name's Doug Phillips. I'm the podcast editor for the American Journal of Neuroradiology. I'd like to welcome you to the August issue. We took a short hiatus for the summer in the month of July. Now we're back with the editors and fellows' choices from the August issue. Let's begin with the editor's choices. The first paper by Sakogios et al., entitled Feasibility of Angiographic CT in Peri-Interventional Diagnostic Imaging, a Comparative Study with Multi-Detector CT. This paper was first published online April 1, 2010. The world of interventional neuroradiology has grown in complexity, and as many of us are familiar, the modern interventional neuroradiologist may work with angiographic equipment that is also capable of obtaining CT images. Flat panel detectors and fan beam technology has brought this to the angiographic suite. The ability to rapidly perform CT images on an angiographic unit can be of considerable advantage when images are required emergently. This can be particularly advantageous when hemorrhages or other complications of a procedure are suspected during or immediately after an interventional procedure. In these cases, the interventionalist may be able to obtain a CT examination and move forward with therapy within the angiographic suite, not requiring that the patient be transported to an adjacent CT facility. In this study, the authors compared the results of angiography-based CT with those of traditional multi-detector CT in 84 patients. These patients had a variety of interventional therapies, including following aneurysm coiling, following thrombectomy, or angioplasty with stent deployment. Patients underwent both forms of evaluation. Both CT methods rated equally in the detection of supratentorial complications, obviously the most important complication being hemorrhage, but multi-detector CT was clearly superior in the evaluation of posterior fossa complications when compared to angiographic CT. On this basis, the authors have concluded that angiographic CT can be a very useful test and can provide additional information important in patient management, with the exception of the evaluation of cerebellar infarctions. The next paper of the editor's choices for the August 2010 issue by Lowe et al., entitled Higher Rates of Mortality But Not Morbidity Follow Intracranial Mechanical Thrombectomy in the Elderly. This paper was first published online by the American Journal of Neuroradiology on April 15, 2010. In this article, the authors have compared thrombectomy performed using the Mercy Clot Retrieval Device in patients of two groups, those younger or older than 80 years of age. The authors sought to determine the influence of age on procedural outcome. We all understand that this is an incredibly important, significant observation as we are dealing daily with an increasingly aged population. They looked at the following parameters in both patient groups: recanalization rates, hospital length of stay, hemorrhagic transformation, and death and disability on discharge. Interestingly, the only significant difference in these parameters was the death rate, which was much more common in the elderly. Percentages here: 48% in the patient population group over 80 versus 15% in those younger than 80. The other parameters showed no statistically significant difference between the two groups. What's the lesson to be learned here? Well, this important observation needs to be kept in mind when performing this procedure in patients of advanced age, and it will certainly be useful in obtaining consent and in counseling families of elderly patients undergoing mechanical thrombectomy. Our next paper of the editor's choices for the August 2010 issue of the American Journal of Neuroradiology by Puig et al., entitled Wallerian degeneration in the corticospinal tract, evaluated by diffusion tensor imaging, correlates with motor deficit 30 days after middle cerebral artery ischemic stroke. This paper was first published online on March 18, 2010. Wallerian degeneration is a common phenomenon seen very often after middle cerebral artery infarctions. This loss of the normal axonal projections from dead or dying neurons leads to a very characteristic loss of volume in significant cases, evident on cross-sectional imaging. It also signifies a worse prognosis when it is present. The authors used diffusion tensor imaging, as well as fractional anisotropy, or FA measurements, as well as signal changes seen on conventional MR images to assess Wallerian degeneration after middle cerebral artery infarctions. 60 patients were evaluated within 12 hours of infarct onset, again at 3 days, and finally at 30 days following infarction. All of their results were compared with ratings according to the NIH stroke scale. At day 30, fractional anisotropy, or FA, in the ipsilateral corticospinal tract was significantly lower when compared with the opposite hemisphere and the opposite corticospinal tracts. This finding also correlated strongly with the presence of a significant motor deficit. The authors have suggested that FA at 30 days post-infarction may serve as a surrogate marker for future stroke studies. Moving now to the fellows' choices for the August issue of the American Journal of Neuroradiology. The first paper by Siddiqui et al., entitled Imaging Characteristics of Primary Laryngeal Lymphoma. This article was first published online on April 1, 2010. Primary extranodal lymphoma is quite rare within the larynx. Less than 100 cases have been reported in the literature. And here, in this paper, the authors have reported the MR, CT, and PET findings in 20 such primary laryngeal lymphoma cases. The patient's age, between 30 and 90 years of age, varied widely, but this entity was more common in females overall. Typically, at presentation, these tumors were quite large, averaging approximately 4 centimeters in size, and tended to begin in the supraglottic region, but variably extended into the infraglottic and hypopharyngeal areas in about 60% of patients. Cartilage invasion and lymph nodes were positive in 20% of patients, and all of these tumors showed hyperactivity on PET scan. No tumors showed central necrosis, and all enhanced uniformly. Although these tumors are exceedingly rare, the combination of these findings may suggest the diagnosis. Bulky lesions lacking central necrosis with uniform enhancement may indicate primary laryngeal lymphoma. The next paper of the fellow's choices for the August issue of AJNR by Lazzaro et al., entitled Artery of Percheron Infarction, Imaging Patterns and Clinical Spectrum. This paper was first published online on March 18, 2010. A number of years ago, Mauricio Castillo, the editor for the American Journal of Neuroradiology, wrote a short case report on this topic. It has, interestingly enough, been in the American Journal of Neuroradiology's most read list. You can think about this article as a steroid-enhanced version of that initial article. In this series, the authors have collected 37 patients with occlusion of the artery of Percheron that were seen over a 9-year data collection period. The most common patterns seen were involvement of the medial thalamine midbrain, medial thalami without midbrain, both of those sites including the anterior thalamus, and medial and anterior thalamic involvement without midbrain involvement. Additionally, of note, FLIR hyperintensity on the surfaces of the interpeduncular cistern were seen in nearly 2/3 of the patients. And this sign, referred to in this article as the V sign, may be used to support the diagnosis of occlusion of the artery of Percheron. Recognition of this sign may help manage patients, as this type of infarction should not be considered a typical lacunar infarction pattern. Remember, of course, that the artery of Percheron is the replacement of normal bilateral thalamic and midbrain perforators with a large dominant artery, referred to as the artery of Percheron, supplying bilaterally the thalami and midbrain. Although these are incredibly unusual, very atypical, and even somewhat rare infarctions, it is certainly of interest to see the high interest that's been shown by the readership in this unusual, very atypical infarction pattern. The final paper of the Fellows' Choices for August AJNR is a very interesting article by Furtado et al. Entitled "The Triple Rule-Out for Acute Ischemic Stroke, Imaging the Brain, Carotid Arteries, Aorta, and Heart." This article was first published online in June 10, 2010. This is an NIH-sponsored study, which in this first go is essentially a technical feasibility and initial review of an interesting imaging paradigm. In this study, the authors sought to assess the utility of a comprehensive imaging protocol for stroke patients that imaged the entirety of the heart, all the chambers, the coronary arteries, the extracranial carotid and vertebral circulation, as well as the intracranial carotid and vertebral circulation and circle of Willis. Patients also obviously had their brains imaged, quite an imaging tour de force. The reason that we might be interested in the coronary arteries in stroke patients is that in patients who are known to have significant coronary disease, the disease overall carries a worse prognosis. The inclusion criteria gathered 120 patients who were evaluated in this very interesting manner. With regards to the study quality, 100% of the studies of the aorta, carotid, and vertebral arteries were judged to be of excellent quality, while 58 to 73% of the coronary artery studies were judged as good. In this study, none of the coronary studies were premedicated with beta blockers to reduce heart rate. They were all gated acquisitions, however. At the conclusion of this feasibility portion of the study, the authors have concluded that this stroke protocol achieved excellent opacification of the left heart chambers, the cervical cerebral arteries, and each coronary artery. A million questions are raised by this study. Because of the interest in this form of cerebral vascular as well as coronary vascular evaluation, my choice for an interview this month is with the senior author of this paper, Max Wintermark.
It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Max Wintermark for our monthly interview on the podcast for the American Journal of Radiology. Max is currently the division director and associate professor of radiology at the University of Virginia Health Systems. Max, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for inviting me on your podcast.
I know you've done these before. I did a sterling job with one of the early podcasts on CT perfusion. Today we're talking about a little bit of a different topic. Your paper that has been selected as a fellow's choice, "The Triple Rule-Out for Acute Ischemic Stroke." Would you mind giving our listeners a little brief introduction to what this paper is about?
Not at all. The idea behind this paper is that when you evaluate an acute ischemic stroke patient, you are interested in knowing if they have an occluded vessel. That's number one. You want also to evaluate how much damage the occluded vessel has caused, and you want to have some idea about the infarct core and potentially also about the ischemic penumbra. But you're also interested, whatever it's at the moment of the admission and the initial imaging or at a later time point, to have some idea about the origin of the stroke, because depending on whether the stroke was caused by a carotid problem, by a cardiac problem, your strategy for managing the patient is going to be very different. And typically when you look at how acute ischemic stroke patients are taken care of, there have been a shift over the years. And so typically they used to get only a non-contrast CT of the head, and the acute treatment decision was based on this non-contrast CT of the head. And more and more now we are getting advanced imaging in those acute ischemic stroke patients to know more about, the location of the clot, the presence of salvageable tissue. But there is still, after the patients have been admitted, a very important workout to determine what's the origin of the stroke. And patients typically have to go through a battery of tests, including some kind of carotid and carotid vascular imaging, possibly also a transthoracic or transesophageal echocardiogram. And in a number of cases, also the vascular surgeon, when they find significant carotid disease, are interested in knowing about the coronary status of the patient. So that was kind of a little bit the background when we started thinking about the study that we performed. And really our study was based on the fact that now that we have modern CT scanners that are able to image all those arteries extremely fast, finally, would there be a way to image not only the intracranial arteries, but also the neck arteries and at the same time the heart? And really the two questions that we asked was, is that technically feasible? And the second question that, of course, is the next logical question is, does it really matter? Is it clinically relevant? And so we performed this study under the auspices of a NIH grant, and we prospectively enrolled patients admitted in the emergency room with a suspected acute stroke. Of course, because we consented the patient in the study, we were not able to enroll a patient with a severe stroke and aphasia who were not consentable. So our population was perhaps a little bit biased towards either TIAs or smaller strokes, or perhaps stroke patient admitted beyond the time window, because again, our main concern was not to interfere at all with the care of these patients. And we developed a specific CT protocol that allowed us to look not only at the intracranial and cervical carotid arteries, but also at the coronary arteries. And it was a relatively sophisticated CT protocol with two acquisitions, one non-gated for the neck and the head, and one acquisition gated by the ECG for the heart, with dual injection iodinated contrast bolus. So it was a protocol we developed, and we tested it into those patients, and we find that the protocol was working well and that the image quality that we're getting in this patient was very acceptable, with the additional limitation that, again, in those acute ischemic stroke patients, you cannot necessarily prepare them as you would normally prepare a patient for a cardiac CTA with beta blockers and so on. And the result of part of the study about the technical feasibility has been published in this recent issue of AJNR. And the second thing, perhaps, and I don't know if you want me to stop because you have questions or if you want me to continue, but the second thing is we also looked at the relevance, finally, of obtaining this additional cardiac imaging in acute stroke patients. And that's the second study that was just accepted for publication. And I think that the EPUB ahead of print is present on PubMed in the stroke journal.
All of the information you've given us, it makes a lot of sense to us, because I think, as we've all learned through the entirety of our training, vascular disease is a whole body thing affecting peripheral vasculature, coronary vasculature, as well as the cerebral vasculature. And I'm sure many of us are at sites, and I certainly remember it very well, where we were often asked to evaluate the carotids via CTA in patients who had coronary disease who were being prepared for surgery. So I think essentially what you have done is you've put now the stroke kind of like in the front of the imaging protocol. The way these patients are entering this imaging protocol is by essentially displaying some cerebral vascular disease that requires imaging.
And that was, I think, the main idea. It was also to kind of facilitate the workup of the patient, because that way the patient, instead of being admitted, having some initial brain imaging and then having a battery of three or four tests to get a complete kind of overview of the patient and the degree of vascular disease that the patient has, potentially you had this opportunity to have one single test at the point of entry of the patient in the medical system that would give you a complete overview about the degree of vascular disease present in that particular patient. And our idea was that potentially that would help making better decisions at an earlier stage and also potentially saving costs.
You know, and again, it makes perfect sense, and I think we can all understand that. So maybe I'm leading you into the article that you have alluded to, published in Stroke. How does the presence or absence of coronary disease influence these patients' management? Or is this simply a risk assessment for these patients for subsequent or later medical care, or does it influence how they are managed acutely while they're in with stroke?
When we went from the technical aspect of the project to the clinical relevance part of the project, our expectation was also to find that patients with carotid disease were more significantly likely to have also coronary disease, because that's kind of the general idea out there, as you just mentioned. There have been a number of studies that have been performed on that topic, but when you look carefully at those studies, what is really interesting is that they use different ways to assess carotid and coronary disease. Sometimes they use the clinical symptoms. Sometimes they used one imaging technique for one type of artery, for instance, the carotid arteries, and they used the stress test to evaluate the coronary arteries. And also in a number of studies, the evaluation of the carotid and the coronary arteries happen at different times, so not necessarily the same day, but potentially separated by 3 or 6 months. And so we were very interested in our study to finally being able to look at the two arteries, the carotid and the coronary arteries, at the same time with the same imaging technique. And the result that we find was quite surprising, because we find that actually when you look at very mild atherosclerotic disease, it tends indeed to be present in multiple vascular beds at the same time, meaning the carotid, the coronary, the aorta, the vertebral arteries. But we find in our population that actually the significant atherosclerotic disease tended to be present in only one vascular bed. So typically, for instance, in 79% of our patients, so 4 patients out of 5, when they had significant vascular disease in terms of significant stenosis, it tended to be present in only one vascular bed. In other words, we find that when you have, for instance, several carotid disease, you are not necessarily very likely to have very significant coronary disease. So perhaps actually it's not necessarily very relevant clinically to every single patient who has a stroke or who has a suspicion of stroke to look at the coronary arteries. And I think the point I would like really to stress is when you look at that kind of conclusion, you should be very careful about the design of the study and you should be very careful about your patient population. And I want again to remind that the patients that were able to enroll in our study were not severe stroke patients, because those patients needed to be treated or were not able to consent. So we had a population of either mild strokes or TIAs or stroke mimics. And in this particular population, it's probably not justified to systematically evaluate their coronary arteries.
I think that is a very important finding and certainly something that the readers need to take away. And I'm relatively certain that about everyone will want to peruse the article on stroke to read all the clinical relevance. Can you tell us, for those of us who don't routinely do coronary or cardiac CT, CTA, the sensitivity of this exam? Can you take it from both sides? For left ventricle disease, the sensitivity of a cardiac CTA to show potential thrombogenic disease in the ventricle over a TEE, and do the same thing with the coronary CTA over the diagnosis provided by cardiac cath.
With coronary CT, I think it has been demonstrated the test with a very good negative predictive value. So in other words, if a patient shows up with an intermediate probability of cardiac events, so symptoms but are not necessarily very typical, and you get a coronary CTA and the coronary CTA turns out to be normal, you can be pretty confident that the patient does not have any significant coronary disease. And as a result, you can probably send those patients back home. The positive predictive value, on the other hand, has been variable. The values that have been reported have been variable from one study to the other. And as a result, patient, where you find something, usually you need to go to the cath lab to confirm that you have indeed something. And some patients are going to turn out to have something and need to be treated, and other not. So it's kind of a good screening test to kind of exclude a bunch of patients that don't need any further workup. But when you find something, then you need to confirm it with optional coronary angiogram. So that's for the coronary arteries. For the ventricle, I think that there are 2 points I would like to make. I think that cardiac CTA with a dedicated protocol is very good at looking at intracardiac clot, and I think it's probably as good as a TEE. Then you can discuss what is more invasive, because the TEE is more kind of the discomfort for the patient, whereas the CT is more the radiation dose. Also nowadays, there are ways to really reduce the amount of radiation associated with those cardiac CTAs. But I think one thing that is very important to know is if you obtain a plain CTA for your carotid arteries, but you just start the coverage low enough to cover, for instance, the left atrium or the left auricle, you have to be careful because you have sometimes some flow effect that can mimic clots. If you get that kind of study with that kind of coverage, you should look at your left atrium, you should look at your left appendage. But you should always consider that when you see something that looks like a clot, it may be a flow effect, and as a result, you should interpret your findings with caution.
Very excellent points, Max. Any other points that you'd like to bring up to the readers and to our listeners about this article?
The last thing I want to say, I think it's a really very exciting topic, and I think that there are still a number of studies that need to be done. I think that a lot of those studies, sometimes the problem is to be able to enroll a sufficient number of patients for the studies to be really relevant and meaningful, and I think that any possibility to collaborate or to have the same protocol running at different sites will really help collecting more patients and get more meaningful results. And so I just wanted to say that I would be happy to collaborate with colleagues who would have an interest in the similar field.
Excellent, Max. I certainly appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks, Doug. Thanks again for inviting me.
My pleasure. And for the American Journal of Radiology, August podcast, this is Doug Phillips. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again next month.